Minkowski equation on a Kerr background. And sort of similar to the other project, we're going to give you a template code. In this case, a code to look at just a wave propagation on a flat background in spherical polar coordinates. This is a template to get started. Let me just sort of show you that. So it should now be up on the web page. So we've got the distribution of the handout. So I'd suggest just reading through this. This contains some background information on the Tucholsky equation, on the Newman-Penrose formalism, etc. It's coming up. So I'm not sure how much of this we'll actually cover in class. We probably not, because I want to then after this I'm going to go over the generalized harmonic form of the field equations, and then we'll sort of look at the. I mentioned yesterday we're going to look at the structure of gravitational waves, just the two polarizations, and it's very easy to derive that after you do the field equations in generalized harmonic form. So we're just going to sort of flip the order a little bit like that. But just so this is sort of gives you some of the background. And then the problems here start with just looking at this as a mutually separated wave equation in spherical polar coordinates. So this is going to be a 2+1 dimensional simulation. So essentially looking at a solution that's in full three dimensions, but we're going to be dividing out the azimuthal symmetry. So we're going to be just looking at one particular azimuthal number at a time. So it reduces to a 2+1 dimensional simulation. So the first part of the problem is just sort of going through some of the background mathematics and running the sample code that we've given you. And then once you get that going and you're comfortable with that, it would be to modify the code to solve the Tucholsky equation. And the thing that's going to be tricky about the Tucholsky equation, and I must admit there's some in what we've suggested here, there's still some things that are not quite straightforward. The thing that's challenging about the Tucholsky equations are the boundary conditions, both the inner boundary conditions and the outer boundary conditions. So with the wave equation, things are very straightforward. On the inner, in anticipation of having a black hole at the inner boundary eventually. So in the Cartesian coordinates, or in the flat space case, we're just going to put a reflecting boundary condition at some finite radius. Eventually, that will be inside the black hole, and you'll have to do some kind of excision boundary condition. That's going to make things slightly more complicated. And at the outer boundary, the typical approximate radiation conditions are also not quite as trivial to implement. So we sort of suggest here a set of ways to proceed, and so that doing things about as straightforwardly as possible, you'll find things work reasonably well, but there might be some marginal instabilities, and we sort of suggest some ways here in how to get around them. We can talk when you start to get to that point. We can talk more about it, but essentially, the one thing. Let's talk more about that when we get there. But what I want to just show you now is the 2D example. Just go through that. And the one thing that's going to be different is going to be using DV to visualize the results. So that will be one tool that you can use. Because these are going to be two-dimensional simulations. So here's the tar file to download. So let's just do that. Just do it in. Okay, so I've already got a copy there, but. Let me just do everything from scratch. So this is actually going to be a much simpler RNPL file than, for example, with the Burgers equation, because everything here we can do in RNPL. We don't need to do any of these. Okay, so you download it, you extract it, and it should be pretty straightforward to compile. So what we've got here, we've just got a single RNPL file with a source and a make file, and you might have to adjust your environment variables, on the laptops, but it should be relatively straightforward to compile. Let's just look at briefly look at the source. So there's nothing that's really going to be fundamentally different compared to what you did before. The only thing now is we have a two-dimensional coordinate system. So is that still a bit difficult to see, or I can try and increase the font size, or let's try. Okay, so in terms of defining variables, everything is as before, except now we have a two-dimensional coordinate system. So now instead of having just a T and a R coordinate, for instance, we have T, R, and theta as a mutual coordinate. And so the difference then is just the notational in how you introduce this extra coordinate. So in terms of defining the grid, you just add the extra coordinate in the same format as you did the first one, but following it in this way. And similarly, when you define derivative operators, it's exactly the same as before. We have in angle brackets the time index, and then in the first square brackets afterwards is the first spatial coordinates. This would be R in this case, and the second one would be theta. So for example, a derivative here with respect to R, a first order derivative, it's just, R, it's I plus 1 minus I divided by delta. For example, the theta derivative there. So this is a backwards theta derivative. So it's just sort of J minus 1 divided by delta theta. So exactly the same kind of notation, but now just an extra, just the only thing that's different is the notation to incorporate the extra index structure. Similarly, in the residuals, now things look much more complicated because, as before, you have to specify a residual statement at every point in the domain. And before, it was relatively straightforward. You have a one-dimensional domain. You have your interior points. You have your boundary points. If you're adding a sort of Christ-Olliger dissipation, I think Matt spoke about that, you'll sort of have an interior range which will go from sort of 3 to n minus 2, and then you'll have your equations at an equation at 2 at n minus 1, and you'll have your boundary conditions at 1 and n. And now the same kind of thing happens. You just have to separate your domain into all the different equations that you're going to apply there. And so it looks a bit more complicated, but it's really exactly the same kind of structure. So for example, here, this is our interior equation, if you will, going from 3 to n r minus 2, 3 to n theta minus 2, and this is the equation where we use the full dissipation in both the theta phi directions. And then as we sort of go one step closer to the boundary, because the dissipation is a five-point stencil, we sort of turn off dissipation with these operators, and you can look at the way that they're defined. And then, of course, the actual boundary conditions are at 1 nr, 1 n theta. So it's the same structure, it's just a little bit more complicated because now you have to specify the conditions about the boundaries. This particular equation, RNPL, is simpler in the sense that there are no additional include files. You can if you want to do stuff manually. But here everything, this is just a pure hyperbolic equation, no high resolution shock capturing, etc. So this is something you can do entirely within RNPL. Okay, so we've got a couple of examples. So again, we've written our scalar field that we're going to solve as a function of r, theta, and t times e to the I, m, phi. So m is now a constant that we put in. We choose this azimuthal number of the field, and then for that particular number, this equation solves for the remainder. And so in the parameter file, we've sort of given three directories, run m0, run m1, run m2, which have ID files, sample ID files, for one particular value of m. So let's just look at m equals 0. Exactly the same as before. Now we just, of course, we have now not just an nr, we have an n theta as well. So we have to specify the size of our domain in both of the coordinates and the actual bounding box. So r here is, this you can modify. You can choose your inner boundary. which is going to be a Dirichlet boundary condition here, or your outer boundary, which is however far you want the outer boundary. Of course, the theta domain, because of regularity conditions, and that's sort of discussed in the write-up, you really don't want to modify that at all. So for a particular, because it's, so the spherical polar type coordinates are singular on the axis, on theta equals zero and theta equals theta max. And so in the equations, to get a regular evolution, we've enforced the regularity conditions on the axis. You could, in principle, change these. If you wanted to, you know, you could change boundary conditions in theta, but you'd have to change, so you could change the domain in theta, but you'd have to change the boundary conditions. So that for stable evolution, you don't want to change the theta domain. And then this just specifies the initial conditions. So in m equals zero mode here, and then in r and theta, there's some Gaussian distribution. So, yeah, so there is an issue with that in the sense that the Courant condition that you have to specify must sort of be sort of related to the smallest mesh spacing that you have. And so in the spherical polar coordinates, everything's focusing down to a point. So if we actually included the origin, that would be a real issue. But here we're sort of putting a boundary at some finite value at r equals, I think, 2 in this case. And that's because in the black hole case, there is going to be a boundary there. But that's something that you would have to worry about in general. Okay, so let's just run one of these examples. I just want to briefly show you sort of this DV. And I think it's been installed, it has been installed on at least the Toshibas and the desktops and that. So one thing you're going to notice with 2D, so things are much, much slower just because it's 2D. And so things like convergence testing are going to be able to take a little bit more time. And essentially, if you have a unigrid evolution, every time you double the number of points, the runtime scales as essentially 2 to the power d plus 1. So if you're in a 1 plus 1 dimensional simulation, you double the number of points, it takes 4 times as long. You've got twice the spatial resolution, and you have to take twice as many time steps with the same Courant factor to get to the same physical time. In 2 dimensions, it's going to be 8 times as long. In 3 dimensions, 16 times as long. So when you're sort of debugging and testing things in 2 dimensions, just initially keep the number of iterations small. You don't want to run things for very, very long, because when you're doing convergence testing, it'll be sitting there waiting for the code to finish. Okay, so this was a pretty low resolution. Again, the SDFs are produced, but these are now 2D SDFs. And so we use this package DV. And sorry, so DV doesn't have, we can't rescale the fonts. it might be a little bit difficult to see here, but I think in the DV distribution, I didn't put a link here from the web page, but there is some, let's see. And I presume this is installed. They have access to this DV directory, Ben. So it's, because there is a brief HTML documentation over here.
We don't have DV.
It's a binary somewhere.
Oh, so they just have it as a binary. Okay. So I'll add a link to it. I think on Matt's webpage somewhere there's a link to this documentation, but. Sort of a very sort of brief overview of how to use DV. So this is available on Matt's webpage, at least at the old Vancouver Summer School location. But I'll add a link to our page. So the way you use it, at least the way that you load data into DV, is the same as with XVS. It's you use SDF, but now not to XVS, but to DV. We don't want to be here. We want to be at wave 2D. To DV. So in this case, the field, we had the field phi, but we sort of reduced it to first order. We introduced the time derivative, which is pi, and then Actually, phi, I think, is the actual field. So there are a couple of fields, but we're just going to look at one of them for now. So the way that DV operates is you can send a whole bunch of what are called these registers, but just grid functions. And so in XVS, it immediately opened up a little visual window onto the particular function. Here, it just lists the function. If you double-click on it, you will have access to all the time. So this was run in 400 and something iterations, going from sort of t equals 0 all the way down to t equals 106. If you right-click on it, then it opens a little sort of a visualization view. And so the scale of things might not quite, you might have to rescale things to see there. So the heads-up display. So this is our initial Gaussian pulse. So this looks very weird because it's interpreting this as a Cartesian grid. So you can see, you probably can't read that up, but what it's saying, so the first coordinate, the radial coordinate, goes from 2 to 50, so that's this direction. And then the azimuthal coordinate goes from 0 to pi. And it just, so if you right-click on something, it will show you the corresponding time. You can do it as a solid, you can look at a wireframe, sort of you can manipulate it with a mouse. I've been using this so much, I sort of automatically know what the various functions for zooming and rotating, but on that little documentation, it will say what it is. So left button lets you rotate, so is right button. Middle button translates, left and middle button together zooms. But so it's all mouse-based. If you click on one of these times, it will open up what grids are at that time. This is a unigrid function, so there's only going to be one particular grid. So there's nothing unusual here. Eventually, this thing can also handle sort of data with adaptive mesh refinement and was run on a parallel environment. So at one time, there could be hundreds of grids, different levels, etc. But in this case, it's just unigrid. If you want to actually see what the data is, there's this data browser, and so you can actually look at the numbers. But for the most part, this is most useful just as a visualization tool. For this particular project, there might be a useful function. If you click on functions, you can do various operations with grid functions. You can add them, subtract them, divide them, etc., as long as they have exactly the same structure. But there's a function, if you scroll down a little bit, that says r theta to xy. So it will, what it will do is it will convert or it will associate a spherical polar type coordinate system with this grid. So if you left click on the function here, you say go, it does that particular function. And now it's produced a new grid function with that change in coordinates. And so this is sort of what we want to imagine. This is what we imagine a spherical polar type coordinate system, right? So this is our inner boundary. That was at r equals 2. We go to r equals 50. And now this is theta from 0 to pi. Oops. So if you click on one grid function sort of at the top level and you click on this, it says send to local view. This is the local view window. It will sort of animate the whole thing. Just a couple of options. If you click on this option button, that sort of controls how it visualizes this 2D function as a surface. So what it's doing is it's converting into its surface, so it's giving it some height. And the height is proportional to the magnitude of the field, and it's also coloring it according to the magnitude of the field. And right, the default values is do sort of a relative scaling. So it's every time step, it's adjusting the local height, in this case, so that it's 10% of the width of the field. And even though you can't see it here, it's telling you how much it's scaling it by. So if you want to perhaps see sort of an unscaled view, you can tell it to just keep a fixed scale. So in this case, let's just scale it by 10. And it's also dynamically adjusting the color map. At every instant, it's taking the minimum value of the data and the maximum value, and it's just adjusting it to this sort of temperature map. And if you just want to sort of see a more you can also, here in this color map, enter a fixed scale. So now I'm just saying freeze the scale from negative 0.1 to 0.1 and don't adjust the height. And you can see this sort of more what you expect, right? So that the wave, this is a combination, it's time symmetric data, so there's going to be a combination of an outgoing wave plus an ingoing wave. So you see that it's a Dirichlet condition, so notice it's not, nothing's happening. This thing, it reflects through the origin and then escapes. And so the outgoing radiation condition is not too bad in this case. You can see not much remains, in particular with this kind of scale. So another useful tool, which might be, so it's described in the handout. I'm not sure if it's actually installed, but it should be there. It's a CV test SDF. Okay, that's good. So this is useful even for 1D. It's an automated tool that does convergence testing for you. So XVS, you can do that graphically. It's got a nice convergence test function. It will just take them and automatically do that for you. DV doesn't have that. You can do it manually if you wanted. You know, subtract different levels, coarsen them, etc. But let's just show you. So let me just change the... Let's not run it for that long. This will take forever. So the three resolutions. Okay, level 0, level 1. You can see how quickly doing things in 2D can become trying on one's patience. Just a factor of 8 times as long. So I've just cut down the number of time steps, so this should finish in just a few seconds. So this tool, CV test SDF, it takes sort of 3 SDF files, such as produced by RNPL with level, you know, 3 subsequent levels, and it just does the convergence computation for you. If you just, let's put this in the background. Let's see. Okay. CV test SDF. So this is the usage format, and this is exactly what it computes. It does sort of subtract the two lowest resolution ones, does an L2 norm, and divides it by the same with the two lower resolution ones. And so I think we're almost done with it. Almost done with this. Okay. Let's just look at just what we've got going here. Okay, so again, that's the usual Cartesian type view. Lowest resolution, medium resolution, and here the high resolution. Let's just convert to the spherical polar view. So there's the high resolution one. I've just run it for a little bit now, so of course we wouldn't be sitting here the whole time waiting for the high resolution ones to one. So visually you can sort of see they're sort of giving the same answer, so you might hope that this is in the convergent regime. But then the CV test SDF, you can actually it will compute the numbers. So let's just so one, two. And so this is a second order accurate code, so that the ratio of the norm should tend to 4 if you're getting second order convergence. You can see here at 0 it's sort of an anomalous number, but that's because we're specifying exact initial data. So there's not been any evolution. Also for early times, you're going to get some strange behaviors, the factor of 9. But you can see sort of for intermediate times, we're close to 4, and eventually it starts to deteriorate. But if you went to higher and higher resolutions, the trend towards second order convergence should continue for longer and longer. But this is a useful tool without having to do sort of manually the manipulations in DV. And you can do that if you want to. So you could, for example, in DV, it can do arithmetic on these functions, but only if they have the exact structure. So these don't have the exact structure. They differ by resolutions of 2, but then it's got this function, for example, to coarsen the grids. So you could do a 2-to-1 coarsening, then subtract them, then compute a norm, etc. So you could sort of, you could with these functions do it manually, but it's a bit of a pain. Okay, so that's just a brief overview. So the first part of this Tucholsky project will be just sort of to familiarize yourself with this. So download this 2D wave equation, run it a little bit, you know, play around with DV, and then it will be sort of taking that as a template and updating it to solve the Tucholsky equation. Any questions? Okay, so for the lecture part, I want to go over the generalized harmonic formalism today. So this is just going to be blackboard stuff. I'll turn it off. You notice we're starting to use a blackboard. I'll start over there and get my notes. So as I mentioned yesterday, if we want to go beyond spherically or beyond space-time with symmetries, we have spherical or planar, it turns out, well, there are a couple of problems. One, the usual ADM form. It's a very nice way of looking at the structure of the field equations, but it's only weakly hyperbolic. So you need a new formulation of the field equations that, at least in the Cauchy evolution, is at least strongly or symmetric hyperbolic. But even beyond that, then there's this issue of constraints. So in some sense, the hyperbolicity is sort of a zeroth order thing that you have to satisfy. Okay. Sort of a very rough background, just to show you where we're going. So when you solve a partial differential equation, whether it's analytically or numerically, the character of the equations are very important. In other words, whether it's elliptic, hyperbolic, or parabolic, the way in which you go about solving the equations is very dependent on the nature of the equations. So we want to sort of think of solving the field equations as an initial boundary value problem. We want to specify initial conditions for some system of interest, say, you know, binary black hole space-time or whatever, and we want to evolve it forwards in time. So we want to look at this as an initial boundary value problem. So we want sort of hyperbolic equations. And so we imagine we have a space-time, and we're going to foliate it by these time-like space-like hypersurfaces labeled by time. So we want to specify initial data on some space-like hypersurface. So every direction within this t equals constant hypersurface is space-like. T, we want to be a time-like coordinate, and then we want to evolve space-time in this direction. So in general, to sort of prove, you know, that you've got a well-posed formulation, that it's hyperbolic, that's kind of tricky, but we're going to sort of take a slightly hand-waving approach, which I think sort of captures the essence of it. And so we're going to want equations that are sort of manifestly hyperbolic. And I think the way we're going to do it is if we can come up with the field equations in a way where the principal parts of the equations are just a simple wave operator. So your prototypical wave equation, we'll sort of wave our hands and say, okay, that is sort of proving that this is a hyperbolic formulation. And that's actually, it's not that unsophisticated, actually. So basically, so say we've got some differential equation, say tx, yz. So this is some differential operator acting on a function, f. And we're going to be thinking of equations that are at most second order. So in the partial differential language, at most second partial derivatives of this function appear. And it turns out that in the mathematical literature, how you characterize the nature of this differential operator is entirely dependent on the leading order differential components of this. So if this is a second order partial differential equation, it will only be the second derivatives of this function that determine the character of the equations. And so for example, if you've got if there are no time derivatives, you know, you've got the sort of the Laplace operator. So these, you can have whatever lower order terms, whatever nonlinearities you want, your first derivatives or the function appearing by itself, but it's really just the second derivatives that govern the structure of the equation. So if there are no time derivatives, no second time derivatives, or mixed time-space derivatives, then you've got an elliptic equation. So your prototypical, like the Laplace operator is an example. So if you have sort of a single time derivative and sort of a Laplace operator, you have parabolic equations. And if you have your wave operator plus whatever lower order terms, then you have hyperbolic. And this is what we're going to be after for this Cauchy type 3 plus 1 problem. So we're going to look at the structure of the field equations first just as they are, and we're going to show that we'll be able to see that there's no definite character to the field equations if you just expand out the Einstein equations in the form of Ricci's 8 pi t, or G's 8 pi t. And then we'll see how the harmonic formulation sort of almost by magic puts it into this form, where the principal parts of the equations are just a usual wave operator. So the harmonic coordinate condition. This is actually a very old coordinate condition. So it's a set of, so you know, we have, you know, roughly speaking, we have four coordinate degrees of freedom in a four-dimensional space-time. We have the freedom to change t, x, y, and z to any functions of themselves and define new coordinates. So we can impose a set of four conditions on the four coordinates. And the harmonic coordinate condition is specifically that you demand that each coordinate satisfies a covariant scalar wave operator. And so this operator here, let me just, right, so if you have a scalar function, this is just, I think you've seen this before. Right, this is just the definition, right, of the scalar wave operator acting on a function f. So in some sense, what the harmonic condition is telling us is that here, so x alpha, or one of the space-time coordinates, just think of a t, x, y, z, or whatever. We can have spherical polar, et cetera, but we'll just be looking at Cartesian for now. So what this condition is saying is that each coordinate satisfies the scalar wave operator. And so we have a set of four conditions on the four space-time coordinates. Now, I mean, it's a little bit strange to say that you want your coordinates to satisfy a wave equation. And we'll see sort of mathematically how that sort of does this magic of converting the field equations into hyperbolic equations. And so that sort of in the past, that's how it's been used. So I said it's got sort of a long tradition in relativity. Apparently Einstein used similar conditions even before he had figured out what the field equations are. There's some notes in his handbooks, I think dating back to like 1910 or something, where he used these coordinate conditions and he called them isothermal conditions. I'm not sure why, but they're very useful in understanding the mathematical nature of the field equations. And back in the 60s, they were used to prove the first uniqueness and existence of solutions to the field equations. So we've got this set of four conditions. But we're going to be using something that's called sort of a generalized harmonic form. So this is what's called harmonic coordinates, the generalized harmonic coordinates. And it's useful just to do the whole derivation in generalized harmonic coordinates, so we can easily switch back to harmonic. What you do is, you instead of saying that each of these space-time coordinates satisfies a homogeneous wave equation, you add some source term to the right-hand side. So some arbitrary function of space and time, whatever. Right, so it's just extending this. And these are some arbitrary set of functions, four functions. And later we'll see so that this in some sense allows us to sort of have our cake and eat it too. One problem, one possible concern with the harmonic condition is we've used up our four coordinate degrees of freedom. And one reason, so this is a really, I said it's a sort of an illustrious history in the mathematical study of the field equations. It was never really used in numerical relativity because there was sort of a slightly misguided notion that this would generically develop coordinate singularities. And so the reason that you can imagine why it might is so if the coordinates satisfy a wave equation, sort of difficult to imagine what that might mean. But so here we've got our time slice. Let's just say there's some strong field regime here that causes a perturbation in the space-time. So the space-time, the coordinates are linked. Some wave in the space-time propagates out. So now in the coordinates, you've also got a wave propagating outwards. So if for the time coordinate, right, so you've got these waves in time, in the time slicing that are propagating about. And so what that means in some sense is relative to a coordinate system that didn't have harmonic, say time is moving forwards a little bit faster there, it's going forwards a little bit slower there. But because the time coordinate satisfies a wave equation, you know when waves meet, they superimpose. So even if these were relatively small amplitude waves, if they meet at this point, that might imply that time could move forward very fast here, which is not necessarily too much of a problem, but it could also imply that here things slow down to the point where time would want to go backwards. In terms of, so you could sort of hand-wavingly think that because these coordinates satisfy wave equations, if violent, interesting things happen and waves superimpose, the assumption that T is a time-like coordinate could break down, and if that happens, your scheme breaks down. You won't get a Cauchy evolution. Yeah. So that's if you're in a periodic domain, and if you have a linear wave equation. Or another way of thinking, let's say we don't have a periodic domain, we can always decompose the solution as a sum of, say, plane waves. And that will be okay, but, and so you can write a solution as such, but if, for example, your time function also satisfies a sum of plane waves, and the amplitude becomes sufficiently large. One thing that's a little bit, so Minkowski space-time is an example of a space-time that is harmonic. So all Minkowski, if you just, minus one, zero, zero, zero for the metric, that is a harmonic coordinate. And so in some sense, what the time coordinate is in Minkowski is you sort of have a linear function for the time coordinate. The space ones are all zero. But now if you sort of perturb things, you're going to have waves that are going in time. And if you make the amplitude of the wave large enough, you can do those. You can write the things sort of. You can do that analytic coordinate transformation. There's no problem with that. But in a numerical scheme where you're sort of tying your evolution to what you're assuming is a space-like hypersurface labeled by T equals constant surface, if the amplitude of that wave is sufficiently large that at some point that assumption breaks down, then you get a coordinate singularity. It's not very clear, but the way in which the problems arise is if you. So these are sort of covariant conditions. You haven't really made any, at least in this, we haven't made any assumptions about what the four coordinates are. So I'm writing this as T, sort of suggestively showing it's a time-like coordinate, and these are space-like ones, but they don't have to be. And in general, they won't be. But when we're doing a numerical evolution where we want to specify initial data on some time-like slice and evolve forwards in time with a numerical integration scheme that assumes that the equations are hyperbolic, this coordinate always better remain time-like. So perhaps another way of thinking is that if the waves are sufficiently large, at some point this might stop being a pure time-like coordinate. This coordinate then might sort of pick up the time-like character locally. The metric is always going to be Lorentzian. It's always going to be locally Minkowski. But the representation in terms of a set of coordinates, it might not be apparent in those coordinates. But when we're sort of evolving things numerically, we really want this to remain a time coordinate for all time. So I don't know if that sort of explained it or.
So what I mean is like, when I imagine like a solution to a wave equation, the image that pops in my head is a wave.
Yeah.
Which is certainly not a one-one function.
Yeah.
And coordinates, of course, you want them to be one-one functions. So
yeah.
Sort of,
okay, but it's.
The one thing I'm wondering why you would want to satisfy wave equations when it seems like difficult, maybe not difficult in any real sense, but like the familiar solutions to wave equations.
Yeah, I think perhaps you're asking is like, what sense does it make to do this? Because of the fact that there's going to be oscillatory.
I mean, like you said, you can certainly, you can take any solution to a wave equation and then shrink the domain of the coordinates, like the coordinate hash down until it's 1-1.
Yeah.
But, you know, in that case, like, essentially you're just taking, like, essentially linear functions, like you said.
Yeah.
Like you say, the thing is locally Minkowski, so it's basically just linear functions.
And yeah.
It seems like it must be an easier way to say that.
Yeah, so, so I'm not quite sure if I'm exactly getting the gist of your question, but so perhaps the easiest, one thing to think about, this one reason why this is done is purely as a mathematical trick. And you'll see that when we write out the field equations, it does this. And so you can just, but whatever this means, it sort of, it does that trick. But then the reason why we're sort of doing this is, you might be worried that this is going to create problems in general. But one thing with generalized harmonic coordinates is, in some sense, we haven't fixed the coordinates. Whereas this is a set of constraints. You say that this has to be zero. This, it turns out not to be a constraint at all. And you can see how, from just taking the definition of what this is, take any space-time in any coordinate system you want and just compute this and say, well, let that be the H's. So you haven't restricted any coordinates. So if you think this might be problematic, this offers a route to try to cure that problem. So this, in some sense, this is why sort of people avoided this. And I mean, this might seem like an obvious fix, but it's really only sort of around 2000 that David Garfinkel sort of pointed out that this is an in principle workaround. That you can sort of have your cake, which is this, and eat it too by choosing sort of cleverly choosing these source functions, you're not restricting your gauge. So you're not restricting yourself to the problems of harmonic, but you're using these this nice property of harmonic coordinates.
Yeah. This is not quite the standard equation, because doesn't the wave operator have the coordinates in it that you're also, that are also like being acted on by that operator? Right, you have d alphas in the wave operator acting on x alpha.
Yeah, so you want to think of this. So this is the wave operator acting on a scalar function f of t, x, y, and z. And so the way that you want to think of one of these conditions is you're just saying let this f of t, x, y, and z just be t. So for example, if you want to do box t, that is just 1 over root g alpha root minus g alpha beta, the partial with respect to t, that's just delta beta t. Right, so that is just these, you're sort of treating these as scalar functions, but they just happen to be the simple coordinate. Yeah, so you could also write this in terms of the connection if you wanted. I mean, this form is convenient because it doesn't involve Christoffel symbols. But it's one thing. So the other comment is this looks like a vector. This quantity looks like a vector, and similarly, this might look like a vector. It's not. It's not a vector, a traditional vector in the usual way you think about a vector is how it transforms when you when you change coordinates. In fact, the way that it transforms is, so there's another identity. I believe it's easiest to write it in this form. It just turns out that that if you evaluate box on the set of space coordinates, you get the trace of the Christoffel symbol minus the trace of the Christoffel symbol. So if you want to consider this to be a vector-like quantity, and you can do that, it's fine, but it doesn't transform like a vector. It transforms like the trace of a Christoffel symbol. And this, you know, doesn't transform like a tensor. So you could sort of treat this as a vector equation, but it will be a different, weird kind of vector under coordinate transformations. But in some sense, we're not going to be too worried about that. We're not going to be changing back and forth with coordinates. So we sort of just, perhaps the easiest way to think of these are a set of four scalar conditions and a set of four scalar functions. And we're just using this index notation as a convenient notation to label them. So we don't have to write out all of this at every single time. Okay, so now to see how the field equations change. We want to, I'm just going to write out the Riemann tensor in all its excruciating detail, and then what the harmonic condition implies, and then we'll see how that sort of simplifies stuff. So we look at the field equations in trace reversed form. So you know, usually think of like G alpha beta is 8 pi T alpha beta, and this is R alpha beta minus half R G alpha beta. But we can take the trace of this. So the trace of R is going to be proportional to the trace of T, and then we can substitute in that relationship here and move this to the right-hand side, and that's just what we mean by the trace reversed form of the field equations. And if you do that, you just get R alpha beta is 8 pi T alpha beta minus half G alpha beta T. So we've essentially, the geometry, we were just going to focus on the Ricci tensor. We don't have to look at the Einstein tensor. And at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. It just simplifies things a little bit. Okay, so I don't know of a really simple way of, well, the way of deriving the harmonic equations, it's straightforward, but you sort of just have, you have to sort of expand this in terms of the metric. So just to remind you, let me just write it down. Let's hope I don't make any mistakes. So the Ricci scalar, you know, in terms of the connection. Like, you don't have to copy this down. This is in all textbooks, but I'm just to be complete here, I'm going to do it. And we know that the Christoffel symbols are alpha, beta, delta, say, G. It's going to be beta. So in any case, the point is the Christoffel symbols contain first derivatives of the metric. In the Riemann tensor, here we have sort of first derivatives of the Christoffel symbol. So this is where the second derivative terms are going to come from. These are going to be products of first derivatives at most. So these are still only going to be first derivative terms. But this is sort of where all the nonlinearity in the field equations are coming from. But it's really these terms that are going to determine the characteristic structure of the field equations. Do I have a typo? No, you mean, this should be, am I forgetting it? Or this one? Oh, sorry. Is that? Okay. Yeah, so this is what it should be, whatever I've written. This is just, you know, in the standard text before everyone. But so now, just to show you sort of explicitly the structure, I'm going to write out this in terms of the metric. Let's do it over here. So. Okay. So this factor of a half doesn't really matter, but so just now substituting the Christoffel symbols and just expanding out this first term. This is a nice term, and this is sort of what we want. This is essentially the principal part of the wave operator, right? If we had a function, and you expand this out. So the first, just applying the chain rule, the first term is you're going to get a logarithmic derivative of root g times this term. But this is just first order. So this one term doesn't really determine the characteristic structure. And then taking a derivative of the second one. And the same with the metric, so there's also going to be this metric one. But really, the term that determines the principal parts is this one. So this kind of structure where we have some function, let's write it in that same form. This sort of defines the principal part of a wave operator. And so here we can see if we pick an alpha, pick a beta, we can think of the field equations as a set of 10 equations. So just given a pair of alpha and beta, this here is that function f. And you can see that this term is just modulo this factor of minus half. This is just the principal part of a scalar wave operator acting on one component of the metric. So this is nice, but now we get terms that mess up the character of the equations. So this first term, and then we get a logarithmic second derivative. And here, to going from like Christoffels to getting logs of root g, just use one of the identities that a trace of a Christoffel is related to a root g. So these are all second derivative terms. So this line are the principal parts, and then we've got a set of lower order terms. I don't know if it's I'm not going to write this out explicitly. If you want as an exercise, you can sort of go through it and figure out what they are. But these terms only contain first derivatives of the metric at most. This is where the nonlinearities and the couplings, etc., are going to be, but they're lower order. So these three terms determine the characteristic structure of the field equations. This one is sort of manifestly wave-like. And these are, that just messes things up. So there's no character to the field equations at all. They're not wave-like, they're not hyperbolic, they're not parabolic. And incidentally, the reason why the field equations have such, they're not a well-posed mathematical system of equations just in this raw form is because of the covariance of the theory. You can describe the same physical space-time any coordinate system you want. In other words, the coordinates, they can have space-like null or time-like character, and until you actually fix the coordinates, the equations in some sense shouldn't give you a well-posed system. Or perhaps another way of thinking about it, from an evolution point of view, we want to start with a metric. If we think of these as being first order, sort of second order differential equation, in a usual Cauchy evolution thing, you'd expect to say, give the value of the metric and its first time derivative at the initial slice, and then you'll solve forwards in time. But just think of doing this with Minkowski spacetime. So we want to solve for Minkowski spacetime for all time. Is it sufficient to say that, you know, g is eta, minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and g dot is 0? Well, you know, will we get that for all time? And you shouldn't get that for all time, because you can say, well, let's take Minkowski space and do a coordinate transformation where some point in the future we just start mixing up the coordinates. So we change the representation of Minkowski spacetime, but do it in such a way that at this t equals 0, this is Minkowski and this is 0. Right, so we can do arbitrary coordinate transformations to the future and have the same initial data. So you know that the field equations better not give you a well-posed initial boundary value problem unless you fix the gauge. So in a well-posedness means, you know, unique solutions given initial data. We know just from this example, because of coordinate transformations, we better not be able to get uniqueness. So from that point of view, it's not surprising at all that the character is messed up. But now with harmonic, we are going to be fixing the gauge. And so that's where you can sort of get uniqueness and well-posedness. Okay, so we've just got a few minutes left. I think enough time at least to show what happens with harmonic. So what we're going to do, so we're going to take this definition, and we can actually look at this particular function. So the symmetric gradient of the source function. So we're just going to take the definition of what this is in terms of the metric and compute the symmetric derivative of this. And if you do that, from this definition, this is just taking the wave equation definition and the delta. What you get is minus g gamma delta. Okay, so the thing to notice, so this is just an identity. There's no just carrying through with the calculus. But so here, these are again just first order derivatives at most, right? This is just parentheses. We're just symmetrizing here. So these terms are first order derivatives at most, but these are second derivatives of G. And if you notice, like look at this term, right? It's exactly minus that term. And same with this one. It's exactly minus that one. So if we sort of solve for these two terms and we substitute in, replace those, so move this to this side, and replace those terms in these equations, we get the following. Right, we get this. And I guess right. So now these are the principal parts of the equations. This does contain second derivatives of the metric from there. But this now jumps down to these lower order terms. I'm not going to write it out. So at this stage, we've just we've just rewritten things in terms of this variable h. We really haven't done anything. But now if we impose the harmonic coordinate condition, so if we now impose that h is equal to 0, then this term vanishes. And all we're left with in the principal part of the equation is this, the principal part of the wave operator. So you can see that by imposing the harmonic condition, we fix the character of the field equations. We get a nice, for each one of the, for each one of these equations, we get a wave operator acting on the metric. And so sort of almost by magic, we've got a system which is sort of manifestly hyperbolic without going into sort of the rigorous proofs of it. I think you can see, because this is sort of the prototypical wave operator, we've fixed that problem. And perhaps just for completeness, let me just write out the full field equations in this generalized harmonic form, and then we can carry on with the discussion tomorrow. So this fixes the one problem that I mentioned. So the ADM form, and I guess as Luis also discussed, is only weakly hyperbolic. So this fixes that. So now we've got a form of the field equations which is strongly hyperbolic. That, however, is not by itself enough because we still have this issue of constraints. Right, so let me just write down. So the field equations now in sort of generalized harmonic form. And so we have this nice principal part. We have these terms. And so I'll discuss this more tomorrow, but when we go to generalized harmonic form and we keep these terms in there, you think, well, okay, are we spoiling again the fact by throwing in second order derivatives? But when you do a generalized harmonic form, you treat these as independent functions. So you don't, in some sense, you're sort of saying, well, we're not going to let the code know, or the method, the structure of the equations know that these are actually related to these. So in some sense, you expand the system of equations by treating these as arbitrary functions. And so you have to supply additional equations to evolve them. And then you run into the problem, well, we don't really want solutions to this expanded system of equations. We only want solutions to the subset where this condition is satisfied. Right. So if you think, well, we can make these arbitrary, in general, that won't be satisfied. So the next problem that has to be solved are these so-called constraint-violating modes. How do you make sure that you start with initial data where this is satisfied? You then treat this as an expanded system, that this is maintained within machine, or sorry, within truncation error. So we'll discuss that tomorrow. But I just wanted to complete this write down the full field equations. So now these are the principal parts. Now these are all the lower order parts with the couplings. Delta, and then this is equal to 8 pi. So just to sort of preview tomorrow, comment. I mentioned in yesterday's lecture that in the last, the latter part of the 1990s and the early 2000s, people came up with dozens, perhaps even hundreds of symmetric hyperbolic formulations of the field equations. In other words, ways of writing the field equations either by fixing the coordinates or choosing variables in an appropriate way, that did make the equations manifestly hyperbolic. So that cured this weakly hyperbolic character of the field equations. But it doesn't matter how you rewrite the field equations, as long as you want to solve them as an initial boundary value problem, there's always going to be some form of constraints that you have to be satisfied. It's sort of fundamental to the Einstein equations, and we'll see that this, in the harmonic form, this set of constraints actually is just the momentum and Hamiltonian constraints that you're used to in the ADM form. And so this is sort of a necessary step, but it's not sufficient. And it turns out that this by itself actually doesn't work. You get exponentially violating solutions, and so we'll go over the so-called this constraint damping idea of how you then can modify this in essentially by adding functions of the constraints to the equations. You can alter the structure of the equations off the Einstein solution space, so whatever that might mean. Okay, any questions? Okay, so we'll do that tomorrow. And again, so I wanted to, in the very first lecture, again, show you the nature of waves, and I wanted to do that today. We didn't get to it, but we'll be able to, from this form, it's pretty straightforward to get to the linearized equations, and then we'll be able to derive the results for the gravitational wave, the structure, the nature of gravitational waves quite easily. Okay, thanks.